The life of Israeli cellist Amit Pellet is one you might only see in the movies. He grew up in an Israeli kibbutz. He picked up the cello to impress a girl. And now, 30 years later, he's playing the cello of Pablo Casals. Well, that's the story and much more behind a new recording called To Brahms with Love from the cello of Pablo Casals with Amit Pellet. It's new classical tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Well, Amit, would you tell me a little bit about yourself, like where you grew up and how you found the cello, or maybe the cello found you?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Israel in a kibbutz, which is a social community of about 500 people, middle of nowhere, mostly agriculture. And luckily, at age 10, which is fourth grade, we all had to start a musical instrument. We were all, when I say all, I mean six kids in a class. But all of us had to choose an instrument. And when the music teacher asked me what I want to play, I said cello, simply because there was a girl who played cello and she was older than me. And I just didn't know how to approach her. So I thought this would be a good plan. I'll play the same thing that she is playing and we'll get married. That's it. And so that's how I started the cello.
So how did that work out? With the girl, I mean.
It did not work out. I never played with her, never talked to her. It's funny because many, many years later, now we are friends. She lives in London, and whenever I play in England, she comes to the concerts, and she knows that. She says, I was not a good cellist, but at least I made somebody else play the cello well. The connection to Casals started already there because my parents, who are not musicians, they wanted to encourage me. So around Hanukkah, which is Christmas time, they bought a tape cassette for me. This was the 80s. And the tape cassette had music for cello and piano played by Pablo Casals. And I used to listen to this tape. I didn't know who he was, of course, and what instrument he played, but I used to listen to it every single night. I have three sisters. We had two bunk beds in one room, and I was up on a bed, and I had this boombox, and I would put the tape and press play and fall asleep with it. And that was it. I fell in love with the cello through that tape cassette. And now, you know, 30 years later, I have this cello that I heard on that tape cassette. So it's sort of a circle closing to that beginning.
It's an amazing story. The more I read about your story, the more intriguing it is. You also went on to study with one of Casals' students, is that right?
Yeah, I went to study. This was another dream of mine. As I grew up in Israel and I became serious about it, I started listening to recordings and played a lot of chamber music. So I listened to the Beaux-Arts Trio. And as I fell in love with the sound of Pablo Casals, I fell in love the same way of the sound of Bernard Greenhaus, whom I didn't know was his student, but that kind of sound of talking voice, human voice through an instrument, something that really attracted me. So I came here to the States to study at Yale University. And after that, I called Mr. Greenhaus, and he retired by then from the trio. And I called him and I said, look, I want to come and study with you. And he was a little bit shocked by the Israeli chutzpah of just calling him and stating that I'm going to study with him. So he said, well, if you can come and play for me, let's see what happens. So I rented a car and I went there. I played for him and he was willing to accept me to study with him, to live with him, same way that he did with Casals many, many years before, sort of like a mentor with a student next door. And I lived there for 3 years and I just observed everything about him. Of course, how to play the cello, how to listen to music, how to appreciate a good martini, how to sail in a boat, everything about him as an artist, as a human being. It was an amazing time of really becoming a musician myself.
So how did Casal's cello find you?
Well, then, you know, my story goes on that after studying with Greenhouse and at Yale University and completing my degrees, I had a Carnegie Hall debut in the America Israel Culture Foundation. They arranged for me to play in Baltimore, just sort of a run-through concert. In that place, in that basically home of a lady who donated to the America Israel Foundation, was the dean of the Peabody Institute. And the dean, after the concert, she said, you know, I really like your playing and so on, and do you like teaching? And of course, again, I used my Israeli chutzpah. I said, oh, I love teaching. Sure. And she said, well, would you want to come tomorrow and give a masterclass at Peabody? And I did that without any notion of being auditioned for the job. But apparently at that time, they did start looking for a new professor at Peabody, because unfortunately the previous one passed away from cancer. That was a great Stephen Cates, a legendary cellist and teacher. I didn't know that. So I was very free at that audition, quote unquote. And when I came back home, home then was in Germany when I did my graduate studies, I told my girlfriend, who is now my wife, that I think it went really well. You know, it's one of those things that you feel that you got it. And as I came home, I got an email from them that they offered me the job. So the two of us in our 20s with two suitcases and a cello ended up in Baltimore. And that leads me to how I met Mrs. Casals Istomin, who lives in Washington. And I met her 6 years ago. The mutual friend from Washington introduced us. And since I'm in the area, I just went into my car and drove to her apartment and played for her. And after what started as sort of an audition and being a lesson, we sat on the couch with a glass of wine, and she offered me the cello of Pablo Casals.
Was it a lesson for her? Were you teaching her, or was she teaching you?
Oh, no, God. I would never dare to teach her. No, she was.
So she was also a cellist.
She was a cellist, and just when she finished study with Casals, she married him. And she was in her 20s. He was 81. But they had quite a few years together before he passed away. And then she inherited the cello and was instructed to give it to a young artist whenever she felt it's the right artist and the right time. And I guess that those two things happened when we met. I played for her, and she started the meeting, which was my audition. She said, you know, Amit, usually I turn my ears off when I hear a young artist, but I didn't do it when you played. So I was extremely happy and honored. And I said, oh, it's a great honor. Thank you so much, Mrs. Casals. And she said, would you mind if I give you some comments? And again, I said, it is my honor and thank you. And she then basically killed me and gave me maybe the most effective lesson I've ever heard, because she went into every note and she said, the maestro, as she referred to her late husband, the maestro wouldn't do this and wouldn't do this. And why are you doing this? And why are you doing this? And I thought, this is it. I'm done. But I realized that she goes into all those details because she maybe liked it. So we kept going piece after piece after piece until the wine time came and sort of saved me from her teeth. But that was an amazing afternoon, and I ended up with a cello. And when I got the cello, she said two things. She said, I want you to have this cello so you can share the legacy of Pablo Casals with the world. But I also want you to go and find out what is your voice through this instrument. And that took me a while to figure out. But I think I start now.
So how did you go about finding your voice on this instrument that is filled with the spirit of Casals?
Well, it has been few phases. The first phase was, of course, everybody expected it to sound like the great Casals, and me too. I tried even subconsciously to imitate him. But then I realized that that's not going to work because I cannot do it. So I stopped that process and I started looking for ways simply to play the cello. And I realized that with these great instruments, old Italian instruments, this cello was made in 1733 in Venice. I realized that with such instruments, one has to learn how not to disturb them in order to find the colors. So I had to, in many ways, relearn how to play the cello, how to approach it in a much more comfortable, relaxed way physically. So instead of choking the instrument, I could bring out the colors and the beauty of voice that it has inside. And then once you do that, you realize it allows you to create colors that simply you didn't know that exist in a way.
Now that you've had your hands on this instrument for a few years, what do you find is so special about it?
Well, two things. One, it has, I think, the most human voice of all instruments. It sounds like an old grandpa telling you a lifetime story. That's very special because some other, like Stradivarius, would be very golden-like sound, like Pavarotti. It's beautiful, but this cello has sort of a character, sort of an earthy sound to it that really feels like that sound has been around for a long time. And the second aspect is just what I said before. It's this ability to find your own voice through it if you just allow it to be what it is and not push it. And it's a very different feeling than playing a bad, quote-unquote, bad instrument where you have to work out and put everything into it in order to bring out something.
To Brahms with Love is your new recording. Brahms is one of your favorite composers, or maybe he's your favorite composer. Why is that?
Well, I think because Brahms represents to us, to humanity, something that we don't have. I always feel that Brahms's music is like heaven, if I can guess what it is, because it's so perfect. There are no disturbances during it. It's just beauty into beauty into beauty. Every phrase that one makes. Where in other composers like Beethoven, whom I adore as much, but Beethoven, the abrupt changes of mood and character and dynamics, it's something that is more like our life. You wake up in the morning, you're happy, you're calm, then you make a phone call or you go to work and boom, it starts. And you go down and then you go up and then one of your kids is sick and has a cold and you have to go back home. And that's more life-like. And that's, I feel like, Schumann or Beethoven, even Haydn, the Sturm und Drang, this abrupt changes of mood. It's much more what we are as humans, and where Brahms is just all beautiful and perfect. And, you know, I want, at the end of the day, if I have a glass of whiskey and I sit on my deck and I want to experience calmness and peaceful, I'll put Brahms. I won't put Beethoven.
Two of your favorite sonatas are featured on this recording, and one is an early sonata by Brahms, the other a later work. And this first sonata, he hadn't written a sonata for any other instrument at that time, is that correct?
That's correct.
So why did he choose cello and piano, do you believe?
Well, he wrote, of course, a sonata for piano, but this is really the first chamber music sonata. And I have my own theory, of course, nobody really knows, but we know that he wrote this sonata when he started writing the first movement when he was on a summer vacation with Clara Schumann. And Schumann himself was dead already for a few years. We read all the love letters between Clara and Johannes, We don't know what happened, but we do know that they had great affection and great emotions to each other. I always believe that he chose the most human romantic instrument, I think, which is a cello, to represent him, where Clara, who was one of the greatest pianists of that time, is represented by the piano part, by this agitated piano moving part. He's sort of, he's telling her what to tell him. Yes, I love you, Johannes. Yes, yes, I do. Even though we don't know if it did work out. But his part is represented by a very low, mellow cello sound, very sustained, beautiful sound, like hot, thick chocolate. And then Clara in the background is always pushing forward with upbeats and upbeats and upbeats. So I feel that this is really sort of a dialogue between Johannes Brahms and Clara Schumann. And that's really the instrument to do that, to write that love letter, is, I think, the cello. Where in the second sonata, Opus 99, which is many, many years later, in that time, it's very connected to his symphonic writing. It's the same key, like the Third Symphony of Brahms. It's a symphonic piece. This is really a piece that one has to imagine. Orchestration. I always imagine Berlin Philharmonic with Herbert von Karajan. And once I start, I play the cello section of Berlin. And then I move to the first flutist of Berlin Philharmonic. And to the first violins, and to the brass, and to the winds. It's a real symphony. So it's really nice to pair them together and to put this kind of intimate love letter between two people into growing into a symphonic representation of a composer.
In the first movement of the first sonata, it's distinctive because of the unusual use of the cello's low register. Do you think that's even amplified more with this instrument?
I want to believe so. I mean, that's the sound I hear in my mind. So as I said before, the instrument will allow you to bring out what you are. And I think finding a way not to disturb this magnificent instrument will allow me to sound more earthy and bass-like, which is what I think is all about in this sonata. We know that Brahms, for instance, he was delighted. He was so happy when his beard started growing, because when he was young, it just didn't grow. So we have this image of him with this long beard and fat and a cigar, this kind of heavy, earthy kind of sound with a beer in hand. That's kind of sound I imagine for the E minor, and it doesn't work any better than a cello on a C string, a low sound on a cello. So this is exactly what I have in mind when I play this sonata and when I record it.
Now, Casals performed the Sonata Number 2 for Brahms himself, and then he went on to record these sonatas on this cello. When you think about all of that, how do you feel when you're playing these works?
Scared. I mean, it's a great feeling, because there is a connection, a living connection to Brahms. My teacher was a student of Casals, who played for Brahms, and then it all concludes in playing on the same instrument, those two sonatas. There's a very beautiful story that Greenhaus used to tell me, that in the sonata where it says poco forte, which means a bit forte, he played it and then Casals stopped it. and told him, no, that's too loud, Bernie. And Greenhouse played it again. And he stopped him again. He said, no, it's too loud. Eventually, it was all sort of a piano, very soft. And Mr. Greenhouse said, Maestro, I'm sorry to say it, but it says poco forte. How do you know that it's supposed to be so soft? And Casals looked at him and said, well, Brahms told me. So what can you say about that?
Wow. You're right. It's a little scary.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, you took this cello, which you refer to as a wild horse ready to run, and you went on a road trip across America. What did it mean to literally follow in Casals' footsteps?
Well, what it means is it goes back to the notion of finding your voice. I remember Marta Casals telling me, go and find your own voice. And I realized through the years of playing this cello that it's not necessarily finding my cello voice. It's finding who I am as a musician, as a human. Because Pablo Casals, more than anything else, was a great humanitarian. He was a great human being helping refugees, playing for people, communicating with people from the stage, talking to people. And so as the more I investigated about what kind of pieces he played in concerts and where he played, I found concert programs of him 100 years ago in Duluth, Minnesota, in Loveland, Colorado, in Tucson, Arizona. You name it, every city that the train stopped between New York and San Francisco, Pablo Casals stopped and played. Each tour used to take about 3 months, and that was a common thing to do for those superstars of those days, for Chrysler, for Casals, for Rubinstein. They all played in those places, and I realized, wait, something is wrong with what we do artists this day. You cannot even imagine having a superstar like Yo-Yo Ma, whom I admire and adore, you know, playing in Duluth, Minnesota. They just don't have the budget to bring him. Where 100 years ago, exactly 100 years ago, Pablo Casals played there. I, in fact, just repeated the program he played in Duluth on March 18, 1918. And I did it on March 18, 2018. So it's just that's exactly the kind of being reachable to the public. So I took it even further and I said, you know what? Instead of waiting for those places to invite me, I'll just rent a truck and I'll go with my pianist and we will just stop in all those places and play. So of course, we didn't play in big places with hundreds of people, but we played in a public library in Bozeman, Montana, and in elementary school here, elementary school there, public park here, public park there. And mostly it was places that I've played before in a bigger venue, so I could connect with people that I knew in that town, and I could inform them that I'm arriving, and they gathered people who love music. So it was really an unbelievable experience, which I can't wait to repeat, because now I know much better how to do it, and I really want to do it again, and now to have a camera with me and to live stream it on Facebook and so on, things that I was not equipped and prepared to do the first time, but to really take music back to the people and in that way to follow the footstep of Pablo Casals to its best.
Now, I know last September you published a children's book called A Cello Named Pablo. Is this your story?
This is my story. Yeah, it is my story that I started this interview with, coming from the kibbutz and playing basketball and then falling in love with a girl. But the way this story is told is by the cello. The cello, which I like to call Pablo, is telling the story to kids. And it's just so wonderful for me to go around the country and before an engagement or after to stay and to go to a kindergarten and to play the cello for kids and then to read the story. And the story is told, as I said, by the cello. The cello is telling, is narrating this story that started in 1733 in Venice, Italy, looking at the canals and then wanting to explore the world, going out and then meeting Pablo Casals, becoming good friends, playing for presidents, for kings and queens, and then falling asleep when Casals died, waking up when I met the cello, becoming friends again. And the punchline of the story, which I really love to see kids with open jaw being shocked, is when the cello is inviting the kids to live up for their dreams and saying, you know, maybe one day if you work hard and live up to your dreams, maybe you will become my best friend and play me forever. So it's just a great way for me to communicate also with kids, because we classical musicians normally communicate with gray hair, white hair people. This is a first time for me that I can excite kids. Some of them raise their hand after the performance of the book and they say, Mr. Pellet, is Pablo really alive? And I always say, I think so. What do you think? And the answer is always, yes. So they really think that the cello is alive. And it's wonderful.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. Be sure to check out other episodes of New Classical Tracks. I'm Julia Macher.